today on Against the Grain, where can resistance to capitalism be found, and how can it be fostered? And what do two currents within eco-socialism, eco-modernism and degrowth, advocate? I'm C.S., Robert Latham and David Ravensbergen, contributors to the volume Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination, join me, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. What if there were a mass movement to dismantle and replace capitalism? Well, perhaps the better question is, how could such a movement even arise? A critical mass of anti-capitalist sentiment has yet to materialize in the U.S., which means, for people like Robert Latham, that the radical left must grow. It must grow and become a powerful, sustained force. But how? From what segments of the U.S. population could a mass anti-capitalist movement emerge or be constructed? Questions like these are at the heart of a new book entitled Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination, edited by Robert Latham, A.T. Kingsmith, Julian Van Bargen, and Nico Bloch. Latham, a professor in the Department of Politics at York University in Toronto, has also contributed an essay with the title Organizing the Contending Masses, From a Struggle With to a Struggle Against Capitalism. Later this hour, you'll hear from another contributor to the volume. David Ravensbergen's essay describes two prominent currents or tendencies within eco-socialism. We begin with Robert Latham, whose other books include The Politics of Evasion and Bombs and Bandwidth, The Emerging Relationship Between Information Technology and Security. When Robert and I connected recently, I brought up a statement he makes in his essay in Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, namely, that when it comes to the possibilities for developing anti-capitalist orientations, we are living in the world of the in-between. I asked what he meant by that.
On the one hand, there's what Lenin wrote about a lot and what we all have been aware of, which is these ruptural moments. That's on one end of a sort of scale of possibilities for transformation from the left as anti-capitalism. And it is that thing we associate with revolutions, when suddenly all the forces come together which produce the possibility of real transformation and the capacities of the state and capital more broadly to effectively repress any possibilities becomes very problematic. And the rupture is a good kind of word, right, for that, because it's like actually the imagery of a kind of volcano rupturing and a breaking forth. And, you know, Lenin, of course, had the Russian Revolution in mind at that time. And then there was hope that after that, in the early parts of Europe, early years of Europe, after the Russian Revolution, especially in Germany, there was hope that that would happen. And it wasn't the case at all. And so that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is the stability. And that's the sort of, and the imagery I use is actually the 1950s, where a sense that things are kind of settled for capitalism and society more generally. Not that there aren't strikes going on, not that there isn't a left active and possibly, unfortunately, a right active, which is looking for ways of transforming and changing the system, challenging it. But more or less, there's a sense of continuity, focus on, you know, developing what is and so on. So those are two ends of the spectrum. Then there's this in-between, which is a period that is neither ruptural nor fully stable. And that began really in the case of, let's say, the global north, North America, but it was affecting Europe, the 60s onward, when we came out of the 50s. And as we know, there was the New Left and all the movements, 1968 in Paris, a lot of strikes, particularly in the 70s. But it's in between because it has these moments of kind of explosion and challenge. But on the other hand, it also has a capitalism and the state in the context of capitalist modernity that is able to hold things together, is able to come up with strategies that continue. And so it's neither ruptural nor stable. And it's a period that we're familiar with, and I think we're still in that same period. And it's not a totally comfortable place to be. It's much better than the stable place.
And so you're interested in where anti-capitalist attitudes and orientations can originate. So what is this context of being in this world of the in-between? What does this mean for the ability of the capacity of anti-capitalist orientations to emerge and to gain significant acceptance among people?
Yeah, I'm framing it. I use a concept I call the contending masses, which is bringing a term which is problematic for many people, the masses, because it's a very generic category. It's not class per se, though it was used by people that had very strong orientations to class. And the masses are, the majority is the working class for sure. But it's not only, and we think of the oppressed more generally, and possibly people that were very easily fitted to what we'd call lower middle class. And this understanding, I use the word contending because it refers to two dimensions of that word. And I'm trying to link them, which is people who are actually struggling in capitalism because of the various insecurities, pressures, forms of life that are, you know, very problematic and oppressive that we associate with it. And then there's the other side, which is the question of how we would move from a struggle with to a struggle against, to actually be in one way or another fighting against capitalism and looking towards something beyond capitalism in the way that things are organized. So this in between where we have these masses that ebb and flow in ruptural moments, a teacher strike and so on, right? And then the mobilizations around Amazon, which have begun to emerge. And then we see on the other side, people that are relatively silent about the whole thing, to refer to a concept Baudrillard called the silent majorities, which I'm not a big fan of, but nonetheless, at the time, he was kind of picking up on something, saying, hey, you know, there's this large group of people that were not behaving the way we thought they'd behave, right, in terms of their relationship to capitalism. And they're either embracing it or just moving on and so on. And the idea is how do we go from that struggle with to the struggle against? And that's, I think, one of the big challenges in this in-between.
So there are a lot of people struggling with capitalism, coping, trying to cope, often unsuccessfully with capitalism. And yeah, so you want to, or the idea is to get many of those people to struggle actually explicitly against capitalism. Do you think it is socioeconomic conditions that determine the potential that will occur, so that in times of economic crisis or insecurity, anti-capitalist attitudes will emerge or are much more likely to emerge and grow?
Yes, that is the case, but there is a caveat, which is that we should not hold out suddenly a great hope and faith that the next crisis is the big one. Right? And you see it all the time. We saw it with the great financial crisis, even with COVID and what's going on, I've even seen it. And among, you know, sophisticated thinkers, activists, organizers, and the hope is always there that this one will make the difference and people will see the difference and they'll be, yes, oh, wait a second here. I'm awakening to the fact that this is not just my life situation, and that suddenly oh my God, I get it. You know, it's the corporations, it's the capitalists, and they're fundamentally different from me. I don't control, I don't own capital, I don't possess, move, work with capital, I don't accumulate capital. They do, and I'm stuck with wages of various forms or sort of petty sort of types of work, you know, these new contract things that have been the last couple decades been emerging that we associate with precarious work. And all of a sudden, wow, I'm awakening. I don't think it's that simple, unfortunately. A few reasons. One is the right has been very, very busy in telling a quite different story to position people who are struggling with capitalism, you know, unemployment, insecurities, debt, all the things that we do associate, if not also climate challenges, and to convince them that this is just a matter of better policy, better action, their bad choices, all the things that we've become familiar with that we typically associate with neoliberalism, but it has a longer legacy. So that's, I think we sometimes have a tendency to underestimate how difficult this actually is, that it's not just a question of crisis. We awake, they awake, and we can bring them into the fold and point out everything they need to realize, and they'll be more susceptible and so on. There can be some of that, absolutely, but we can't take it for granted as a kind of cause, right? A sort of organic cause.
So without such a systemic crisis, what would be needed to move more people toward a critical mass of people toward specifically anti-capitalism, specifically blaming the capitalist system, the capitalist status quo for their plight such that they would want to move against it? Many say, and you write about this in the essay you contributed to this book, Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, co-edited by my guest Robert Latham, who joins us on Against the Grain. Many say that a kind of select group of intellectuals or activists, you know, sometimes termed the vanguard, can help oppressed folks understand the reasons for their oppression and help turn these people into revolutionary actors. Do you agree with that?
Well, I, in principle, do agree, but I don't think it's sufficient. It is a necessary condition, but far from sufficient under the current circumstances. And what I mean by that is that the education and the propaganda, in the positive sense of the term, right, getting the message out there, is always very useful and important. And it can be the case that we do begin to get people, and there can be organic intellectuals, to use Gramsci's term, that emerge. A good example is, I think the first name is Chris Smalls. I mentioned Amazon as an activist, and I thought of him and used as an example as a really kind of, you know, classic organic intellectual that's come out of the struggle of, around work, right? And this is going to happen, and his connecting to people, various organizers and vanguards that exist, is great. But however, the rest of the population is not necessarily going there for all kinds of reasons. Many, there's life choices, there's risks involved, putting yourself on that sort of front lines, possibly losing your job, putting them into bad circumstances that they're not going to be willing to do. I mean, think of what's happened in so many strikes, right? So we have to think of the question, do we think a little bit differently about anti-capitalism beyond just that notion of trying to bring cadre in, higher and higher numbers of cadre? Yes, let's keep doing that. For those who are dedicated to that, absolutely, let them keep doing it and let them be successful. But in this context, in this in-between, it's not enough. And we have to think in different ways, different tactics and strategies about that, to think differently our relationship to the working class and the oppressed, to think of it in terms of the transformations of capitalism that have happened, that are different now than they were 60, 70 years ago, or obviously longer ago. And take that in to think how we could mobilize, you know, culture and various forms of imagery, how to connect to people's lives in a different organic way, to take seriously that someone could be and be doing anti-capitalism without being consciously seeing themselves as anti-capitalists.
Yeah, let's talk about that, because you consider, and you want other people to consider whether, well, first of all, whether people and groups have inadvertently taken anti-capitalist action, and whether that kind of action can be harnessed in a certain way. So what do you mean by inadvertently taking anti-capitalist action?
I mean that they're doing something that runs against, that is non-capitalist, that relates to material organization of their lives and communities, as well as possibly political and social. And I've got, you know, a couple examples that stand out. When one where, you know, the people participating are far less likely to be, you know, self-consciously anti-capitalist, and that's community banking, public banking. It's like a very mundane example in many ways. It's been around for a long time in the States and other places. And it is an anti-capitalist action because it changes the nature of accumulation that's tied to the financial realm. So all those people who say, yeah, community banks, that's, I love my community bank, or I'd love to have another community bank, and I know there's been some votes lately in California around this, they are basically deciding that they want to keep the money in their community and use it for public things. It's very different than putting the money in to the bank and then sends it straight to Wall Street or other forms that advances accumulation. So that's, I consider that therefore anti-capitalist. You could say non-capitalism if one likes, but you're playing with words there between non and anti, right? I mean, another one, of course, that stands out, which is more likely among the participants to be self-conscious anti-capitalism, but not necessarily. I've met many, you know, spending time on the Lower East Side of New York, and that's squatting, right? And it's another action that clearly breaks away from accumulation, commodification of real estate, homes, right? Attempting to, and the very fact that they're doing it is that. So that's another way. So you're, you know, of course, again, you're liking sometimes it's young people, but not always. There's all kinds of squats that take place where you're not talking about sophisticated young, you know, socialist-minded individuals, squatters that are participating in it, right? Many, you have older people that have done it, that have to do it. So that's another example. So that's one end of it. And much of it all depends on how we think of what capitalism is. To understand the anti, you have to understand the capitalism in some practical way.
So what is capitalism to you, and how do you define it?
For me, it's kind of three things, which are nothing surprising, which is first accumulation, but it's subjugating accumulation, which is not just accumulation. That's been going on since the beginning of time, you know, in various empires, accumulation of wealth and even capital. And Marx talks about some of those precedents. But the subjugating form and the constant need to accumulate, the process of bringing more into the world, transforming social relations through capital, and therefore creating greater accumulation. That's what I mean by subjugate. It's not the same as a feudal lord that sits on a land and has an income or various other forms of material power from that. And the other one, of course, very famously, is commodification and the processes of commodifying more and more of life, and which many people have picked up. And, you know, of course, Marx was kind of thinking ahead about that process as well. And so we have the commodification, not just commodities. They've been around for a while in different ways. And then we have finally wage labor, and what I call, you know, my own little sort of way of playing with it, which is wageification. You know, so the more and more of that that's been taking place, as we know, historically, and we now have more wage laborers in the world than ever because of the globalization process, a spread of capitalism. So on what terms is one moving away from that, moving away from one of those three core characteristics? And there's other forms. I'm not saying there's an essence. Capitalism is way too complicated, and people could come up with different ways of framing it, but for me, those work as basic characteristics that don't say that, try to say there's something totally historically unique, but that they come together as a increasing process that takes over more and more relations, more and more ways of having our world's communities organized, lives, and so on. And so let's find those places where people are pushing away from the accumulation, pushing away from the wages, and working, figuring out other ways of compensating value amongst themselves and exchange and things, and then pushing away from commodities and look for all those things and what people are doing and try to link them up and try to think through, hey, look what you're doing here. This is really interesting. How about connecting to this? Or have you thought about what is really going on? We could extend this more, and building up organically, sort of bottom up in that sense. So that's what I'm looking, thinking about in terms of the possibilities.
And you mentioned Marx. How interested was Karl Marx in anti-capitalist or non-capitalist initiatives that did not involve proletarian revolution?
I think Marx was very interested in these things. I think he looked for things wherever they were taking place. I mean, the most famous example would be the Paris Commune, even though he was skeptical, I think, that it would succeed. He saw that that was a very legitimate action, and it didn't necessarily only involve a classic proletariat revolution in the sense that we would take that in historical terms. And there were all kinds of different classes involved, petty bourgeois and so on. They were really challenging, organizing around in very sort of, you know, non-state, you know, communal ways, hence the term Paris Commune and all that. So that's one example. He looked later in his life where he saw peasant communalism in Russia. And there were some letters written to him asking, well, does this make any sense in the way you frame things? He said, absolutely. So it wasn't like he was looking, no, I want to see it pass through these, you know, absolute strict forms, historical forms of A, B, C, and so on. No, he said, no, I see really something important there. And there's other examples. I mean, even when he got involved in the International, what's called the First International, he was interested to seeing wherever things are happening, actions, strikes, which may not be, you know, the precipice for some kind of massive national revolution. Yes, he understood that they can just end up being reformist and not go beyond that, but he said this is also the breeding ground for the development of possibly anti-capitalist consciousness and for more organizing. So, and being, you know, so committed to that First International, he allowed for great diversity in that, in the organizational forms, the type of participants. In fact, he ended up in a big battle with anarchist tendencies inside the International, but he allowed it to take place. He understood that we have to look for all of the challenges wherever we can find them and not be closed-minded and doctrinaire about them. So I think there is a real precedent there.
That's Robert Latham. We'll return to more of my conversation with the York University professor later this hour. We turn now to another contributor to the book, Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left. David Ravensbergen's essay has the title, The Anthropocene and Us, Grounds for an Augmented Left. David Ravensbergen is a PhD student in social and political thought at York University. He's also a writer and union activist. When I connected with David recently, I asked him to describe a key tendency or current within eco-socialism. It's called eco-modernism.
So when speaking about eco-modernism, it's important to make a distinction between what I would think of as high eco-modernism, mainstream eco-modernism, represented by groups like the Breakthrough Institute, and socialist eco-modernism, eco-socialist eco-modernism. There's significant overlap between the two, but they are somewhat distinct. Eco-modernism, as promoted by the Breakthrough Institute, is what is described by many of its proponents as a variant of post-environmentalist thought. So it's kind of rooted in this recognition that environmentalism as a social movement, as an attempt to limit the destruction of nature, was a failed strategy, and that instead of what eco-modernists would say was, you know, a kind of romantic movement of kind of back to the land or, you know, valuing nature for its own sake, eco-modernism proposes to really take the management of nature into human hands. And in doing so, they advocate a vision of high technology development. They advocate intensive urbanization. They advocate nuclear power and a kind of concentration of human activity in smaller and smaller areas, leading to the possibility of rewilding greater parts of the Earth and allowing species that are currently under pressure from sprawling development a chance to regain a foothold. Now, the left variant of eco-modernism is, it's rooted in Marxism. It's rooted in a kind of Promethean current that we find throughout the history of Marxism, a kind of emphasis placed on the scientific mastery of nature, on the importance of technological and industrial development as expressions of human ingenuity. It has a strong anthropocentric focus, so really, really thinking about the world through the lens of what is important for human purposes.
Tell me a little bit more about technology and the promise that it holds out for eco-modernists, I think of either stripe, of both stripes, although maybe the emphasis is different, as you were saying. What kinds of technologies do eco-modernists appeal to? Do they say will help us get out of or address the ecological crisis?
Well, the key thing to highlight for an eco-modernist perspective is that the most realistic, the most achievable, the most promising avenue for social transformation, for resolving the ecological crisis, is through technological development. So they would say, you know, we're not going to pursue a strategy of changing social relations or, you know, the structure of the economy, but rather we want to unleash the potential of science and technological progress to provide solutions to the challenges that we face. So, you know, there's not complete consensus on which technologies are put forward as possible solutions, but they range from nuclear power to what we're seeing increasingly emphasized now in the climate debate, geoengineering technologies, carbon capture and storage, and other kind of large-scale direct interventions into the natural world to dramatically bring down carbon emissions, to limit the scale of ecological disaster.
In your essay, you bring up some of what Aaron Bastani has written about eco-modernism. What does Bastani say about whether we need to reduce energy use, and also about the promise and potential of asteroid mining?
So Bastani's position, and you know, it's an evolving one, so I'm referring back to something that he wrote a couple of years ago. It may have changed, but he argues essentially that the idea that responding to the climate crisis would require reductions in energy use doesn't feel right to him. You know, as a real proponent of technological development, as an engine of social change, he sees, you know, the falling cost of solar energy, of wind energy. He sees this as evidence that we're on a kind of trajectory that's going to allow us to continue to develop in the way that we have. It's going to continue to allow rising energy consumption, material consumption around the world, because we are getting more adept. We're becoming more adept at harnessing what he thinks of as the limitless power energy of the sun. And this kind of is, you know, this is the transition to the asteroid question. Bastani is a big fan of some companies that seem fairly speculative today, although there is increasing interest from, you know, billionaires like Elon Musk and Jeff Bezos in the question of space exploration and space extraction. Bastani is interested in companies like Planetary Resources, who claim that there are within our solar system, reachable from Earth, near-Earth asteroids that contain trillions of dollars in valuable metals and minerals. And their proposition is that if we are able to go to space and extract those metals and minerals, that we will essentially solve the problem of scarcity once and for all and lay the groundwork for a kind of intergalactic civilizational expansion. And so Bastani, you know, puts a left gloss on this and says, you know, if we are to overcome scarcity as these companies claim, well, we might as well then implement communism.
And I want to get your kind of evaluation of eco-modernism as we discuss, as I have you discuss, the debates between eco-modernists and other left tendencies. And let's talk about kind of the left tendency that you put in opposition to, that you claim justifiably kind of contrasts with an eco-modernist vision, and that is degrowth. What are the basic features of the degrowth outlook?
So there's a number of different ways to define and to approach degrowth. I think the way that I'm going to take is to locate it also within the Marxist tradition. And that's not something that is shared by all advocates of degrowth. But nonetheless, I think it's a useful illustration. So as I was saying about eco-modernism drawing on this kind of forces of production determinism within Marxism that sees technology as the driving force of progress of history, there's a kind of a countercurrent that I would say is in some ways nicely illustrated by a figure like Walter Benjamin. For Walter Benjamin, we don't think of history as being this unfolding of technological progress and, you know, increasing perfection that will eventually create the conditions for a socialist society. But in the Theses on the Philosophy of History, Benjamin has this evocative image of the angel of progress being borne forward into the future on the storm of progress, looking back at the accumulation of disaster behind. And so for Benjamin, the idea of a kind of a revolutionary, a socialist politics is to find a way to pull the emergency brake on this kind of out of control developmental train. Thinking about the problem as it appeared in his lifetime in the first half of the 20th century, Benjamin said that the German labor movement's greatest downfall was that it believed it was swimming with the current of technological development. And so that's a way of thinking about degrowth is, you know, it is a movement against the grain, if you will, to say that the development of capitalist modernity and industrial progress, while it certainly contains beneficial elements, is to be resisted and contains within it a kind of logic of endless expansion, endless growth, and also endless degradation and destruction of nature that needs to be fundamentally stopped and overturned.
Yeah, and here I think you're referring to the D in degrowth, right? That there is so often a focus on economic growth and economic progress, human progress. The degrowth folks are pushing back against that. And what specifically, and maybe it's hard to generalize, but what specifically do they call for?
So, I mean, I think a degrowth politics really rests fundamentally on this recognition that ceaseless growth is one of the kind of primary organizing principles of all societies, essentially, within contemporary global capitalism. And to organize your society, any society, around endless expansion is to invite a whole host of problems. You know, so we see the kind of demand for endless consumption of energy in the form of fossil fuels is driving the climate crisis. endless demand for metals, materials is driving rampant extractivism and the social dislocation that results. We see the promotion of a kind of restless consumerism, endless desire for more is the driving force behind the exploitation of labor in around the world, but increasingly, you know, in poor countries in the global south. It's driving the accumulation of waste and garbage that is disrupting ecosystems. So degrowth really points to the fact that we have a politics that uses this quite innocent language of, you know, GDP growth and expansion and so on, and claims that this is a kind of uncontested social good for everyone, because the more growth we have, the more there is for everyone. Degrowth says, you know, this is a fundamentally irrational and destructive organizing principle, and we need to consider other ways of organizing society, and not just consider. You know, this is it's an urgent imperative in light of the rapidly vanishing window of time to act to limit carbon emissions and to slow and mitigate many of the other facets of the ecological crisis, including the unfolding sixth mass extinction.
My guest is David Ravensbergen. He is a union activist. He's a PhD student at York University in Toronto. He's published work on Marxism, climate change, and the political economy of the environment. I'm C.S. Song, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I think when many people, well, maybe the people who consider degrowth politics, many of them might discern a tenor of scarcity, of deprivation, of going without, doing without, right? Degrowth has this image of no longer moving forward and no longer expecting the kinds of consumption patterns and other ways of living that we have become accustomed to. How do you respond to that? I mean, what should we say about whether degrowth promises scarcity, in contrast, by the way, to the kind of vision of abundance that many eco-modernists forward, such as, you know, Aaron Bastani, who, as you said, did not believe that we needed to reduce energy use because, after all, there are clean energy sources in abundance.
Yeah, I think this is really one of the most common points of contention in the debate between a degrowth and an eco-modernist position. I think the first thing that I would say is that although degrowth is often accused of advocating a politics of scarcity, it is in fact, you know, the reigning neoliberal consensus, rooted as it is in neoclassical economics, which is actually grounded fundamentally in scarcity. You know, the idea of growth, which can be traced back, actually has been traced back usefully by degrowth scholar Yorgos Kallas to Malthus, is that, you know, we exist under conditions of fundamental scarcity. There's not enough to go around, and the only reasonable way of responding to that is to pursue a politics, a political economy of endless growth, of endlessly getting more. But I think that it's clear, you know, whether degrowth or socialist or social democratic, any kind of critical perspective on contemporary capitalism would look and see that growth has not delivered the goods. It has delivered an enormous share of wealth to a extraordinarily small percentage of the population, and it is generating increasing instability and precarity and ecological degradation for the majority. So I contest the idea that degrowth is a politics in scarcity. I would say that it's the dominant paradigm of neoliberalism that is rooted in scarcity, and that the eco-modernist position actually shares much more in common with that neoliberal paradigm. in accepting this need for constant growth. I would say that, you know, degrowth scholars have been quite clear that degrowth should not be seen as synonymous with austerity politics or with some kind of enforced poverty. You know, again, if we look at the austerity politics that have characterized the neoliberal era, the kind of cuts that have been made to social spending, the sacrifices in quality of life that people have been asked to make, those have all been made for the sake of growth. You know, we've all been told we need to make these sacrifices, we need to suffer cuts to education funding, we need to suffer cuts to healthcare funding, to pensions, all in order for the economy to grow. I think, in contrast, degrowth envisions a world where scarcity is not it's not a kind of timeless law, it's not a fundamental principle of the planet, it's rather something that is socially constructed. And it's socially constructed by the system of capitalism. Whereas, you know, degrowth says perhaps it is not scarcity, but rather abundance that characterizes this planet that we live on together. And the question is not, you know, should we do with less or should we do with more, but it's rather a qualitative question. You know, degrowth is really a kind of a project of democratically, of collectively asking, how do we want to meet our needs? How do we want to satisfy our desires? Is it only through this kind of singular metric of growth and endless expansion that we can do that? Or are there other ways that would be less destructive, less oppressive to people, less exploitative, and perhaps most fundamentally of all, would be less apocalyptic for the ecosystems that we depend upon?
Well, you know, we've been talking a lot about kind of how to address the environmental and ecological crisis. You mentioned jobs creation. The Green New Deal obviously has a high degree of visibility these days. It's become a rallying cry for climate activists. What do you think of the sort of policy package that is the Green New Deal?
There are some potential problems with the Green New Deal. One problem that we could think of is, you know, the analogy, the clear connection that's being made here to the original New Deal points to the problem that, you know, is really highlighted by the degrowth perspective. If we think of the original New Deal policy as, in some senses, designed to really salvage an ailing capitalist system in the United States and shore up domestic capital accumulation, I think that there's a lot of that that original goal from the New Deal is present in the Green New Deal. And this is a major problem in a situation in which we can really identify ceaseless economic growth as one of the primary drivers of the climate and ecological crisis. Another issue that comes up is that the Green New Deal is kind of obscuring some other political frameworks for thinking about the climate crisis that have been fought for by activists, by movements, by countries in the global south for years. And one of those in particular is the climate justice perspective. And the key thing to take away from the climate justice perspective is this emphasis on unequal responsibility for the climate crisis. You know, the overwhelming majority of emissions have come from the countries of the capitalist core, the United States, Western Europe, Japan. But it's also the unequal vulnerability to the effects of the climate crisis. So it's primarily, you know, those who have contributed the least in the global south who are most vulnerable to the most severe effects of extreme weather, flooding, famine, and so on. And so with the Green New Deal framing, there's a tendency to think about the problem of climate change and climate policy really as a domestic problem. You know, it's how do we create jobs in the United States for American workers? How do we fix American cities and so on? And the thing is, you know, if we're really talking seriously about, you know, massive electrification of transportation, a massive shift to renewable energy and so on, that is a, that's a project that is going to depend on raw materials, minerals, supply chains that stretch into the global south, into the countries that have historically, you know, again, borne the brunt of extraction, of economic dependence within the capitalist global economy. So I think it's important to recognize that there are these kind of tendencies within the Green New Deal discourse, a tendency to think of it in terms of, you know, domestic economies, or to think of it in terms of a means of jump-starting growth that we need to be aware of. But nonetheless, it is a, it's a promising opening in the sense that there's a real opportunity to influence the shape of discussions around what the political response to this unprecedented ecological crisis will be.
That's David Ravensbergen talking with me about the essay he contributed to the volume Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination, published by Fernwood Publishing. We've put a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. You've heard about two of the essays included in the volume, but what else does the book contain, and what is its unifying theme? I put that question to the book's co-editor, Robert Latham.
At the broadest level, there's a kind of argument about, we use a subtitle of the book, which is Recasting Leftist Imagination. Now, others have used the concept of leftist imagination, imagination more broadly. We use it a particular way. So we do it to first argue, on the one hand, how can we reimagine left agency, which is relevant to some of the things I spoke of earlier, how the left acts, how it organizes, how it engages with the working class and the oppressed. And then, on the other hand, reimagining the relationship between that reimagined agency on the left, on the part of the left, and its organizing, and the transformations that are taking place and have been taking place in capitalist modernity. So this is overarching element that we're particularly concerned with. And the idea of, we use the word, the phrase, I should say, augmenting the left. And the point is that augmenting it speaks to a different imagination that way. And there's one basic starting point as far as augmentation, which is something that I'm taking from Frantz Fanon, which is stretching Marxism as a way of broadening out. And there's been a long tradition since he worked in trying to himself do that stretching that has been taking place. So let's build that. Let's think about what those things mean. And there's also the question of how we can even use that Marxian heritage to navigate the divisions that are actually taking place on the radical left and have been for a long time. Like rethink the connections among economic, political, and cultural factors that bear, you know, in the working class, you know, and so see those all kind of, those connections more as Mobius strips rather than bounded structures that are very formally held in place. So, you know, that kind of rethinking political consciousness, the role of political consciousness, emotions, identity, ideology, institutions, right? And how they relate to forces of production, logics of class, you know, and also we have to situate, finally, I'd say, the augmentation process and the theoretical terrain in this current social political context, and then how that speaks to possibilities for organizing a bit differently. And there's lots of examples through the volume of these attempts in these different areas to think them through and how to approach anti-capitalism a bit differently. So those are the things that are working through the volume that way. The number of sections that are, you know, speak about working class organization. There's also a section on new cultural forms, a section on dealing with nationalism, and the emergence of the new right, and the possibilities of reframing our organization that way. There's how do we gauge the state and the non-state forms of organizing. But we have lots of divides. I mean, building political parties, and that becomes one issue there, which how do you build constituencies for parties that may be a bit differently than in the past, and certainly since we can't take for granted a kind of consciousness that already had emerged long ago in the 19th century into the first half of the 20th century. And then finally, there's different approaches to mobilizing culture, imagery, and various ways of understanding even the role of anxiety and the role of art, which many people have been speaking of in the arts, but understanding insurgent art in relationship to the left itself, and not just on its own terms. And then finally, importantly, is environmental transformations and eco-socialism and the challenges for those movements, because it doesn't end no matter how good Extinction Rebellion is and various other battles of the environment. We have a long way to go, as everybody will recognize. So there's some attempts to think through some of the terms of that, both within North America, but importantly, the global South.
Robert Latham, professor in the Department of Politics at York University in Toronto. His books include The Politics of Evasion, Bombs and Bandwidth, The Emerging Relationship Between Information Technology and Security, and The Liberal Moment, Modernity, Security, and the Making of Post-War International Order. We've been talking about an essay he contributed to a book that he has co-edited with A.T. Kingsmith, Julian von Bargen, and Nico Bloch. It's called Challenging the Right, Augmenting the Left, Recasting Leftist Imagination. Congratulations, Robert, on the book, and thanks so much for joining us today.
It was my pleasure, and thank you for your attention to it.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.